call the conference committee on House File 840, the tax conference committee, to order. We have a quorum. What I'd like to do first of all is make an announcement that staff could kind of leave the microphones where they are and don't try to bend them because they're not supposed to move. So be careful with those if you would. With that, I think what we'll do is we'll start with some introductions. We'll go to the department, then we'll want staff to spend two fun-filled weeks together. And so we need to know who's who. So, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's really good to be back in room 15 with the House members again. And I'm Rod Skoy, Senator from Senate District 2, which is a large part of northern Minnesota. I actually represent the chimney of the state, that little part of Minnesota that the northwest angle is in. They have a Lake of the Woods County has a county board meeting every year up in the angle. And in order to get to the county board meeting from Babette, it's about a 2.5-hour drive. And you have to go through customs because you go through Canada to get there. So it's a very interesting part of Minnesota. But that is in my Senate district. I go south to south of Park Rapids, Monaga area, west over toward the Red River Valley, around Detroit Lakes, includes Itasca State Park, Beltrami Island State Forest. The Red Lakes are in my district. Big chunk of northern rural Minnesota. So part of where I'm from, and looking forward to having a chance to argue for provisions important to that part of the state and listening to what you guys have on your minds and where you're from and what's up with all of the areas that you're down here representing. So glad to be here.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm Lyle Coonan. Represent Senate District 17 in West Central Minnesota, which includes the counties of Candiohi, Swift, Chippewa, and most of Renville County. It's for the most part farm country, except for northern Candiohi, where we're known for some very nice lakes there, but I'm proud to say. It's also, unfortunately, at this point, the epicenter of the avian flu right now, so we're busy dealing with that too, which is pretty stressful for those folks, and I'm hoping that we can find solutions to that, you know, fairly soon now, but we'll see where things go with that. The good news is that as of the last report now, in the last 24 hours, there's been no new cases in Minnesota, which is good news. But I'm happy to be here. I was a member of the House for almost 10 years and on the Tax Committee there for 8 years and now on the Tax Committee here in the Senate, so it's good to be with all of you, and I look forward to working with you.
Chair Davids, Senator Paul Gazelka, as you know, I was in the House before as well. For any of you that don't know it, I'm from God's Country, which is the west side of the Brainerd Lakes area, all the way out to Wadena, south down to the Long Prairie area, and back over to the Little Falls, Morrison County area. I have Camp Ripley in my district, so that's one of the major employers and people that really do good things for our whole state. But I had the privilege of being on the committee last year, and on the Senate side, it's exactly the same. In some ways, it'd be a dream team, except I wouldn't mind a few more of somebody on there. But I see your side, Mr. Chair, is quite a bit different. So it should be fun again this year to find some good tax policy together.
Chair Skoy, members, Chris Wozenski, House District 16A. I represent kind of the southwest portion, a little bit northwest portion, or north central portion, Lacaparral County, Yellow Madison County, so the other side of Granite Falls. Represent Senator Conan and I will chair part of that city. Lyon County, which would be Marshall, Schwann's Ice Cream, as kind of our large employer down there, but largely agriculture, and a sliver of Redwood County as well. So agriculture, manufacturing, I think, part of our district. And a lot of small cities and towns, and a couple big ones too. So.
Hi, everybody. Steve Dryskowski and I represent House District 21B in southeastern Minnesota, the northern portion of Winona County, southern portions of Wabasha and Goodhue County, and a sliver of Dodge County. And we live in the banana belt of Minnesota, where we've got warm weather, and relatively speaking, and about 31 inches of rainfall a year. So The biggest city in my district is Goodview, which is 4,000 people. And so it's a scattering similar to Representative Swazinski's area of small towns and agriculture. Look forward to working with everybody.
Yeah, I'm Greg Davids, District 28B. I represent a district, Fillmore and Houston Counties, which borders Iowa and Wisconsin, right down in the corner. So Senator Skoy is way, way up north, and I'm way, way down south. So there's quite a divide there. I'm just glad our tax bills are a lot closer than we are geographically. So with that, I'll
there. Hi, I'm State Representative Bob Barrett from Chisago County, right north of here, right outside of the seven-county metro area. Some cities in my district include North Branch, Taylor's Falls, Wyoming, Chisago City, and, of course, Lindstrom. Lindstrom's very happy right now. We have our umlauts back, and we're very proud and happy to have our umlauts back. We missed them, but they're here, so it's been a good year so far. Hoping to get better. We're kind of in a unique situation from a commercial industrial perspective. I think we were named. One of the folks from Deed came to our North Branch Chamber meeting luncheon and said that we were like one of the, I shouldn't say this out loud, but we're like the fourth highest cost per living in the whole state just because of where we're at. And a lot of folks drive down to the Twin Cities to find work. So we're trying to get more commercial industrial. We don't necessarily compare favorably with Wisconsin, who has some advantages. Someone said one time the former director of our county EDA said that about 17 of the 20 businesses in the Osceola Industrial Park, Osceola, Wisconsin, are either from Minnesota or have branched out into Wisconsin. So we're trying to make some changes there, trying to get more competitive. But I disagree with Senator Gazelka. I live in God's country. So maybe there's two of them. Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I hope that's the smallest of all our disagreements.
Thank you, Chair Davids. And I want to, my name's Ann Lincheski, and I represent a portion of Bloomington. There's three House seats in Bloomington and two senators, so I'm fortunate that I represent along the Minnesota River Valley. So kind of south, west, central, and east Bloomington. And for folks who aren't familiar where that is in Minnesota, it's actually a second ring suburb. It's not in the inner ring suburbs. It's outside of the 494-694 Beltway. So that's the perspective, I guess, I bring to this. And I do want to thank you first, Mr. Chair, though, for appointing me to this, and I appreciate that. I want to thank Speaker Doubt. And I want to thank Chair Skoy and the senators who are here. I know we'll all do good things together, and looking forward to being as helpful as I can. And I see Commissioner Bowerly is here, and I know the governor is relying on all of us as well to get things done for Minnesota, and happy to be here. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carrie Dietzick. I represent East Minneapolis, so I'm a portion of Minneapolis, the University of Minnesota, Augsburg College. I have St. Kate's Nursing School in my area, and I also represent Cedar Riverside, which is the largest Somali population in probably the country. So I have a very diverse urban area. I'm honored to be here and be back again and look forward to working with all of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ann Rest, and I represent first, second, and third tier suburbs of Minneapolis in western Hennepin County. I am the vice chair of the committee and the chair of the tax reform division, and for 4 years, when I was a member of the House, I chaired the House Tax Committee.
And thank you very much. And on the House side, of course, we have former Chair Lincheski, Vice Chair Barrett, and Division Chair Graskowski. Now, if we could go to the department, and then we'll have introductions of staff here. We're very fortunate to have Commissioner Bowerly here. If you could introduce yourself.
Department, many of whom are Ivy Leff, Amy Hang, and Nathan Jessen. You will see a lot of us and anyone else that from the department who might be able to help you as we move forward.
Thank you. I think it's so department it's so important to get the input from the department because we're the ones that have to make it work. So let's start out with Mr. Michael.
Joel Michael from House Research.
Pat Dalton from House Research.
Steve Hines, House Research.
Chris Klayman, House Research.
Nina Manzi, House Research.
Good afternoon. Kathy Schill, House Fiscal.
Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal.
Stephen Rubis, Tax Scale.
Jack Paulson, Senate Counsel and Research.
Eric Sylvia, Senate Counsel and Research.
Nora Pollack, Senate Counsel.
Shelby McQuay, Senate Counsel, Research and Fiscal Analysis.
And thank you very much. Yeah, Senator Rest.
I wonder, the fixed mics at the outside table really shouldn't be moved back and forth. They're designed to be straight on, and it really wears at them in a way that is not helpful to us. So I wonder if people would not switch them back and forth. It's not like the mics in the House. Really make that request, please.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And if you have any questions or problems, just talk to me. If you have any that you want to get some results on, you might want to talk to Andrew Hasek, who is the committee legislative assistant in Grant. Grant Erickson, who is the Property Tax Division CLA. So with that, I think we'll just dive right into the bills here that we have for House File, or the bill, House File 848. I'd like to start out, go to tab the side-by-sides, and we'll start with Mr. Michael, and I'm going to need some help on the counterparts from the Senate. Identify yourself for the record. Or Ms. Manzi, you're going to go first? Okay, Ms. Manzi from House Research, if you could please start us out. Income and franchise taxes. Okay, and then
Ms. Pollack.
Ms. Pollack, thank you. Ms. Pollack from the Senate. So if we can go through those issues, start out.
Yes.
Ms. Manzi, Ms. Pollack, let's start out. Ms. Manzi?
And Mr.
Senator Scoy.
And Mr. Chair, just so we kind of, what are exactly are you thinking? Are we going to just do a real high-level overview of these articles, or how much detail do you think we would be going in on?
And I think if it's okay with the committee, we'll kind of have a 30,000-foot view to start out. I will have time later to get into the weeds on some of these things, so maybe not a whole lot of questions for members unless there's something we just need to get on the table right now. Maybe some 30,000-foot observations on the House and the Senate language, and then unless there's something we just need to ask for, we'll do that. And it'd be my intention to everyone that's here, I'd like to get through the side-by-sides very generally today and then bring House and Senate fiscal staffs up here to go through some numbers. And then maybe you'd like to announce right now what your intention is for tomorrow.
Well, Mr. Chair, assuming we can get through what we've got laid out, and I would hope we can if we spend a modest amount of time getting through this. I do have some areas that I think what the Senate wants to bring forth, assuming we're through the discussion of the side-by-side and the spreadsheet. And we'll talk about them once we kind of get through and see. Maybe some of them will be covered today, too. So
we'll see where we're at.
See where we're at then.
Thank you. And if any members, just please get my attention. We'll break in from the staff here if there's some questions.
Mr. Chair, we had understood that you wanted us to just go through the items that were in both bills and the same, or in both bills and different, and touch on the differences.
Let's start out with that.
Okay, very good.
That'd be fine.
Mr. Chair, so on the side-by-side, I think that the first item that is addressed in both bills appears on page 3. This is an item that has several sections. The first pair is House Section 6 and Senate Section 5. There'll be others of these as we go through, which I won't mention. On these are an update to a federal law that was enacted on April 1st that provided for contributions to or charitable organizations to benefit the families of slain officers. Police officers in New York City would be deductible as 2014 contributions on income tax returns that people might still be filing. And Ms. Pollack can comment on what the Senate has.
Mr. Chair and members, the Senate has the exact same provisions.
You know, we should probably adopt that just so we can say we're moving forward.
You know, Mr. Chair, I was thinking that might be a good idea, but I had a little conversation earlier today, and I kind of told people, I didn't think we'd be doing any adoption on this first day, but I wonder if we could break with that.
We'll see how it goes. Chair Rest.
Mr. Chairman, we could, as we go through them, ask the staff to start making a list of the same so that maybe the next time we meet, we could adopt the same as long as they're non-money items.
I think that's a very good idea because once we get the numbers, if that's early next week or way late this week, we're going to have numbers to talk about. And so maybe we can do that with some same and similar together there and see where we're at once we get through Chair Skoy.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, maybe once we get through the income article on the same and the similars, we could just turn to the commissioner and see what her opinion is of those. And
yes, I think that's a good idea. So did you hear that, Commissioner Barley? Okay, what we'll be looking at here is we'll go through a section, for example, income taxes here. And if you have any immediate thoughts before we go to the next section, the next House research folks will turn to you and see if you have some comments. If you don't, we're kind of putting you on the spot here, but if you don't, we'll. Here, but I think that's a good idea to, you know, have the department letting us know what they're thinking about. That this bill is, we're close.
Oh, and Mr. Chair.
Yes, I mean, Chair Skoy.
I thought our goal was to put them on the spot.
Okay, Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the next section where the House and Senate have similar provisions is House Section 8 and Senate Section 7 relating to residency. Both sections make changes to both the statutory residency test and the domicile test in determining the residency of a taxpayer. The change to the statutory residency test is to provide that days that an individual spends in Minnesota for the primary purpose of receiving medical treatment for the individual, the spouse, a child, or a parent do not count as Minnesota days towards the 183-day limit under the statutory residency test. Those provisions are the same in both bills with regard to the medical treatment. The second change is to the domicile test, and this is similar to language that was in, I believe, the Senate bill last year, in which the Department of Revenue and the courts could not consider the location of an individual's attorney, certified public accountant, or financial advisor, or the place of business of a financial institution where the individual has an account in determining if an individual is a resident under the domicile test. And the changes on the House side for that are effective beginning for tax year 2015.
Mr. Chair, the Senate provision is identical, but it has a definition of financial advisor that has a few more provisions, as you can see on page 4 of the side-by-side. The other difference that I would note is that the domicile test changes are effective the day following final enactment, but they would also apply to any open cases in appeals or petitions or complaints that have been filed or opened since April 28th of 2015.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the next provision that is similar in both bills is one of the subtractions in House Section 11 on page 5 of the side-by-side. The House has a subtraction for fitness facility fees of both employees and employers. The subtraction is $40 per employee per month for months in which an employee uses the fitness facility for at least 8 days. and this would apply to fitness facility fees that the employer had paid on behalf of the employee for use of the fitness facility. The Senate has a different approach.
Mr. Chair, on page 5, and the section is 23 on the Senate side, the provision is for a credit to employees whose employers provide or subsidize partially a fitness membership to an off-site facility. The credit is $60 for a married couple filing jointly and $30 for all others. The employee must use the facility an average of 4 times per month, but no fewer than 3. And other than that, the requirements for the type, the definition of fitness facility are the same in both bills.
Mr. Chair, let me find the page where the next provision is. And I'm going to just skip over all of these additional federal conformity provisions. They're the same in both bills, and it's simply a date change reference for the Internal Revenue Code that needs to be changed, I think, in 4 or 5 places in statute. So the next change that we haven't discussed is on page 9, House Section 18 and Senate Section 12. This is a provision from the governor's bill, I believe, which would disallow the working family credit for people who are not Minnesota residents. I think what has happened here is that when income tax reciprocity ended with Wisconsin, a lot of Wisconsin residents began claiming the working family credit because they were required to file Minnesota returns. So this would, it's not all Wisconsin residents, but a good portion of it is, and we have gotten some information from the department on that. But that section is the same in both bills. Okay. The next section is...
Section 9 on page 4. Did we miss that one, or did I miss it? Those are part of federal conformity.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Jaskowski, that's part of federal conformity. In that section, there are some more words on the House side. This is sort of the most substantive place where we amend the date in the statute, and it provides some information on the federal law that was enacted there.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Chair Skoy. Mr. Chair and members, I'm terrible at this, so it's more than a little ironic that I'm bringing this up, but it's really good if you can pull the mics in and speak. This room is, the acoustics aren't very good, and the people can't hear, and staff included. So if you could pull the mics in and speak up a little bit, that's helpful.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Pollock, Ms. Manchin.
Page? Still on page 9, Mr. Chair. House Section 19 and Senate Section 13 modify a subdivision in the working family credit that allows for a portion of the working family credit to be funded with TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. The House language clarifies that the expansion of the credit rates enacted in Chapter 150 in 2014 is not to be funded with TANF, but the TANF is only to be used to fund the working family credit expansion that was enacted in 2000. And the House change is effective retroactively for fiscal year 15 and going forward into the future.
Mr. Chair, the Senate provision is identical with respect to the clarification for the application of the TANF funds to the year 2000 changes. However, the Senate Omnibus Health and Human Services bill repeals the TANF appropriation altogether, and that's being carried in a different vehicle.
Mr. Chair, the next section begins still on page 9 toward the bottom of the page, House Section 21, Senate Section 14. This relates to the K-12 education credit. There are several changes to the K-12 credit that are similar in both bills and some that are in one bill but not the other. So I'll go through these by the type of change. The first change is to increase the credit amount. The House increases it from $1,000 per qualifying child to $1,500 per qualifying child, and that's roughly an adjustment for inflation since the credit was enacted.
Go ahead.
Okay, and Mr. Chair. The Senate does not change the amount of the credit. The second change, as I have them listed, is to increase the income level at which the credit begins to phase out. And again, I believe that these adjustments in both the House and the Senate in this case are intended to increase the phase-out threshold for inflation since the credit was enacted in 1997. The House would increase the phase-out threshold from $33,500 to $47,500. The Senate would increase it slightly less to $45,000. The House then changes the phase-out rate at which, so the rate at which the credit is taken away for people with income over that threshold, so that in the House, the credit would phase out at $56,500 of income for people with one or two children, and then you would add another $4,500 of income for each additional child. The Senate keeps the phase-out rate the same as it is in current law, so it would phase out over $4,000 of income for families with one or two children, and then you would add an additional $2,000 of income to that for each additional child. The next change is to, well, I guess still relating to that phase-out, the House provides for that phase-out threshold to be adjusted annually for inflation after tax year 15, and the Senate would leave it fixed at the $45,000 amount. The next change is that the House extends the credit both to pre-kindergarten expenses and to non-public school tuition. The Senate does not extend the credit to non-public school tuition, but it does extend the credit to a different set of pre-K educational facilities. The House has an extensive list of family daycare homes that are accredited by the Commissioner of Human Services, family daycare centers that are accredited by the Commissioner, pre-kindergarten programs that participate in the Parent Aware Rating Program, Montessori schools, pre-kindergarten programs operated by school districts. The Senate extends it to pre-kindergarten programs operated by school districts and to Head Start programs and limits it to children who have attained the age of 4 during the tax year, I believe.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. Children who have attained the age of 4 at the time the expenses were incurred.
And in Mr. Chair, in both cases, Ms. Pollack and I conferred on this earlier today, and she pointed out something that I hadn't really been on my radar, but in both bills, the extension would apply not just to the actual expense for the pre-kindergarten program, but for any instructional materials or supplies of the program, or if the parent enrolled the child, for instance, in a Suzuki music lessons or something at age 5, it would apply to that. So it would apply to these younger children for any of the things that are currently allowed under the K-12 education credit, the same as it does for children in grades K through 12. I think, Mr. Chair, that's the end on the K-12 credit, and Ms. Pollack is nodding. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, I think the next section where there are similarities is on page 10 of the side-by-side, House Section 25 and Senate Section 16 pertaining to the research and development credit. Both the House and Senate provisions extend the credit to sole proprietors. The House also increases the second tier rate to 4% from the current 2.5. The two provisions have different effective dates. The Senate's beginning in tax year 15 and the House in tax year 16. At the bottom of page 10, House Section 26, Senate Section 18, the provisions for the research credit carryover are the same in both bills. Mr. Chair and members, moving to page 11 of the side-by-side, House Article 1, Section 27, and Senate Article 1, Section 19, provide for some refundability of the research and development credit. The Senate allows the first $15,000 to be refundable, and the House provides that the first $200,000 is refundable. And perhaps Ms. Manzi can speak a little more to the details.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the House is essentially allowing the amount attributable to the first tier rate to be refundable. And I think the other thing to note is that this refundability provision in both the House and Senate would be effective for tax year 2015. The other House components, the extension to sole proprietors and the increase in the rate, are delayed until tax year 16, but the refundability has the same effective date. And then the House and the Senate in House Section 28 and Senate Section 20 both require sole proprietors to become eligible for the credit by applying for certification. They do it in slightly different ways. The House requires application to the Commissioner of Deed, who would then issue credit certificates to sole proprietors who are found to be eligible. And the Senate has the applications go to the Department of Revenue, to the Commissioner of Revenue. There's a different time frame on when the agencies would have to approve the applications after they had received them. The House allows 90 days for approval, and the Senate has 60 days. The other difference is in when the sole proprietors would claim the credit. The House requires sole proprietors to claim the credit on an amended return for the year in which the expenses were incurred, while the Senate has the sole proprietors claim the credit on the following year's return, I believe. Yep.
Okay. 20 minutes. Yep. Okay. Mr. Chair, the next section we'll discuss is House Section 31, Senate Section 21, pertaining to contributions to Minnesota or to 529 plans.
Chair Skoy.
Excuse me. Sorry,
Chair Skoy.
But Mr. Chair, but Ms. Manzi, can you explain to me what is the process for the C corps, the S corps, and partners that are excluded then if they're not to go through the application process?
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, I think that both bodies went about this in a different way but achieved the same end. I think when the application was first drafted for sole proprietors, it inadvertently was written so that everyone would have to apply, the C corps and the partnerships and so forth, and that was not the intent. The intent, after the department shared concerns about the sole proprietors, the application process came forward as an idea, and the intent was just to require the sole proprietors to apply. The language in both bills is a little different on how it says that the other entities don't have to apply, but both bills do say that the other kinds of entities would not be subject to the application requirement.
Chair Skoy?
That's great. Thank you.
Ms. Pollack, Ms. Manson. Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and members, the next section is Section 31 of the House article and Section 21 of the Senate article pertaining to contributions to 529 plans. The Senate provision provides a credit for contributions to only a Minnesota Section 529 plan, and the credit is limited to $500, and any refund resulting from the credit must be deposited into the designated Minnesota College Savings Plan account. The credit formula is indicated on page 12 of the side-by-side. It's a graduated formula based on the percentage of income over the federal poverty guideline and phasing out to $80,000, or phasing up through $80,000. House side also provides a credit to for 529 plan contributions. The House provision would allow the credit for contributions to any state's plan, also a maximum credit of $500. And the income range for which the credit would apply is slightly different.
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Manzi,
to expand on the House provision a little bit, the bill heard in the House originally was the same as the provision that's in the Senate. And when the bill's author, Representative Wills, decided to expand it to all state Section 529 plans, it no longer made sense to require the refunds to be deposited in the Minnesota College Savings Plan, because that's accomplished in the House bill is introduced in the Senate bill by sharing of information between the Department of Revenue and I think the Office of Higher Education with the money transferred to make the deposits in the plan, and I don't think we would be able to administer that with regard to other states' plan. So that piece went away, and instead Representative Wills just has the refunds paid directly to the taxpayers, as is the case with other refundable credits. Another thing that changed is that the credit rate was reduced at the lower end of the income range. I think the Senate's provision and the original bill heard in the House was structured so that the credit rate was actually greater than 100% of the amount contributed as a way to provide an incentive to lower income people to make contributions to plans. So if they contributed $250, as it shows in the chart, then they would get a $500 credit with any amount in excess of their liability simply transferred into the college savings plan that they had set up. Once the provision in the House was made so that there were simply refunds paid to the taxpayer, it no longer made sense to have the higher percentage there. So the percentage was reduced to 50% for lower income filers. And then the House also dropped the tie to the federal poverty guideline for the same reason. I would also add that both bills have the same language with regard to applying a penalty for non-qualified distributions, and other provisions in both sections are the same since they had started out as the same bill.
Ms. Pollack?
Do you want to talk about the veterans? Oh, you should start it. Yeah, okay.
Ms. Bancy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Pollack is going to talk about the Veterans Jobs Tax Credit and Grant. It's still on page 12 of the side-by-side. And I will just add that the House does not have an income tax credit for a hiring of veterans, but in our miscellaneous article, we do require a report from the Commissioner of Revenue on what would be the best way to structure such a credit if we were to have one.
Mr. Chair, the Senate Section 22 provides a tax credit for employers who hire qualifying veterans. The credit is up to $2,500, and it's 10% of the wages paid to the veteran up to that cap. The credit is not available to employers who claim the grant, which I'll discuss in a minute. The grant program is available to local governments and qualifying nonprofit entities who hire qualifying veterans. Again, these entities would not be eligible to receive the tax credit under the employer tax credit program. There are a few restrictions on the hiring of the veteran. For example, the veteran may not be a board member of the nonprofit organization or an elected or appointed official of the local government. Finally, in Section 32, there's an appropriation for the amount to make the grants to the local governments and nonprofits.
Okay, Ms. Fancy.
Mr. Chair, the next section. Yes, I'm looking for it. On the bottom of page 13, there we go, income sourcing for non-resident board members, House Section 35, Senate Section 25. This relates to board directors who are not Minnesota residents, and it would provide that the payments that they receive for their service is sourced to Minnesota based on the share of time that the board member spends in Minnesota providing service. And that's the same in both bills, and it would apply retroactively to all open tax years. The Senate section that amends that same section contains an additional provision that is not in the House bill that's on an unrelated topic.
Nothing further, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, the final section in the income article that has some similarities between the House and the Senate is also on page 14, House Section 38. The House provides a credit for the rehabilitation of a job training center. This is a structure in Minneapolis known as the Old North Branch Library, which was unable to qualify for a historic structure credit, and this is an alternative credit on the House side for the rehabilitation of that building.
Mr. Chair, the Senate provides a grant to Hennepin County for that must be used for the North Branch Library and Emerge Job Training Center.
Both House and Senate take care of the issue there.
Mr. Chair, I believe so. I sent an email to one of the lobbyists working on this issue today asking that question, and I haven't yet received a reply, but when I do, I'll let you know.
Okay, thank you.
Item next.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Skoy.
I think that the Senate heard from the Historic Society, and they had some concerns about the application of the credit on this building, and so we took a little different approach.
Thank you. That's Article 1. Now I'll go to the department for some comments. You okay with Article 1? Hey, it's Article 2? No. If you could kind of give it, and it's kind of putting you on the spot here, but kind of give an overview of some areas where you, like I've said many times, this doesn't work unless you can do it. Okay, so if you could kind of give us a summary of your thoughts on Article 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. First, I would like to note that we really appreciate the working family credit disallowance for full-time non-residents. We appreciate the inclusion of the governor's provision there, so there's a lot of commonality already. We do want to make sure that we share with you all of the administrative concerns that the department is able to address, because at the end of the day, we want to make sure that we can apply and implement the intent of the legislature as you pass statutes. And so we are in the process and nearly complete with an initial administrative comment memo that we would share with you. We're hoping later today or tomorrow. But just in short, on the provisions that you just covered, with respect to the residency provisions, we would like to continue the discussion about the impact of the medical treatment days provision. On the financial advisor definitions, we would look to align those and have some thoughts on how we might be able to help you do that. We appreciate the efforts at federal conformity throughout the bill, and particularly we think the slain officer provision, although it may not be something that is taken a great deal of advantage in Minnesota, is important to allow those Minnesotans who want to contribute to that officer fund for those slain officers in New York to do so. With respect to the K-12 provisions, as you know, the governor also in his supplemental budget, had a provision with respect to this, and so there's a lot of agreement about moving forward with some changes to this credit, and we look forward to continuing the conversation on these issues. With respect to the research and development credit, we look forward to continuing the conversation to make this provision as administrable as possible. And we've also been listening closely to the feedback that has been heard in both houses about this provision and the importance to those sole proprietors. And so we want to make sure that we understand the intentions, and we may have some suggestions that we hope would meet the shared feedback that we heard throughout the committee process. With respect to the 529 plans, we do have some administrative questions we would like to share and to make sure that the definitions can meet the implementation that you all intend. And on the board income sourcing, we have also some definitional questions that we would like to make sure we are clear on to make sure that we can administer it as you intend. And as I mentioned, we will also we will continue to share, and we appreciate the opportunity to work with you and with all of the fiscal and research staff to make sure that the bill is as clean as possible.
Thank you, Commissioner. Okay, with that, we'll go to Article 2, Property Tax Empowerment, and who will be handling that as far as research goes? Mr. Hines and
Sames.
Sames. Okay, we have Mr. Hines, Mr. Clayman,
and Mr. Sylvia.
Okay, who would like to start with Article 2, page 16?
Mr. Chair, we would like to start with Article 3, property taxes.
Article?
Page 23, that would be Section 7 of the House.
Oh, Article 2 is just House?
Article 2 is just House.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So, Mr. Clayman, let's go, and members, let's go page 22, Article 3. Mr. Clayman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, on page 23, Section 7, Appeals and Equalization Course Requirement for Local Boards. The House has a provision that restricts the application of a requirement for one member of a local board of appeal and equalization to have attended a class on appeals and equalization. That would restrict application of that requirement to years where the Commissioner of Revenue offers a certain number of in-person training sessions to local board members. And that requirement to hold those in-person training sessions sunsets when the Office of Broadband Development certifies that all jurisdictions subject to the requirement to have the one board member present who has attended one of those classes has been certified that broadband service is available in those jurisdictions.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and members, the Senate does not amend the same section, but it has an uncodified section that requires the Department of Revenue in consultation with the Minnesota Association of Townships to not offer not less than 12 in-person Board of Appeals and Equalization course trainings in both 2015 and 2016.
Yes, the next, Mr. Chair, the next section that's in common is Section 10 of the House bill, Section 11 of the Senate bill, that allows special taxing districts to certify their proposed levies, their truth and taxation levies, at September 30th. So it allows them 2 extra weeks, 15 days compared to what they have now, which puts them at the same date as the other taxing jurisdictions.
Mr. Sylvia?
Mr. Chair, members, the Senate has the same identical provision.
Item next. Mr. Clayman?
Mr. Chair, members, the next similar provision would be Section 17 on page 25. Oh, sorry.
I guess, Mr. Hines? Mr. Chair, the next three, I guess, would be Sections 14, 15, and 16 in the House. 19, 20, and 21 in the Senate. And those are provisions that I believe were brought to us by the County Association that allows them to enter in agreements for repurchasing properties at interest rates equal to the rate allowable under confession of judgment agreements. There's three sections because one deals with contract for deed purchases and one under installment payment agreements.
Mr. Chair, the Senate has those three identical provisions. They are Article 2, Sections 19, 20, and 21.
Okay, thank you. Mr.
Kramer? Thank you. Moving on to Section 17 on page 25, Sustainable Forest Incentive Act Withdrawal Procedures. The House bill has a provision to allow early withdrawal from the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act program, Sustainable Forest Incentive Act program, when the state acquires either a state or a political subdivision of the state acquires either a conservation easement on the land enrolled that is similar to the restrictions that would exist under the SFIA, or the land is subject to acquisition easement or lease by the state or a political subdivision for the purpose of creating a paved public trail. And actually, I believe with respect to the conservation easement, I believe that only the House language only applies to the state acquisition. So.
Mr. Sylvia?
Mr. Chair, the Senate has a separate article, Article 11, just dealing with Sustainable Forest Incentive Act modifications. What is similar in this section is relating to the withdrawal procedures. The Senate, and I won't go into too much detail, but changes the length of covenants, 8, 20, and 50-year covenants, and would allow for early withdrawal procedures as well as procedures if you have been in the covenant at least half the time based on the 8, 20, or 50-year covenant. There are some similarities, language changes relating to current owner of enrolled land versus approved claimant. That's a section that we also amend in the article, as well as relating to the transfer of ownership and if it's based on the current owner or someone that subsequently purchased the land. In addition, for purposes of early withdrawal for easements, the Senate also references a government or a nonprofit entity instead of the state, as appears in the House bill.
Chairman Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with regard to the Sustainable Forestry Initiative Act, we have a pretty major redo of this provision in our bill. And at some point, we'd like an opportunity to have further conversation about what our proposal is. We looked at the legislative auditor's report and made some adjustments. And, you know, maybe tomorrow would be an opportunity, but I don't think we'll delve into it now. But I just wanted to bring it up that we have a pretty major redo here.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. Item next.
1927.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Section 19 of the House, 27 of the Senate, provides for a property to be removed from the Metropolitan Ag Preserves Program upon the death of the owner of the property or an owner of the property. And if the preserve is terminated under this provision, the property is subject to additional taxes equal to 50% of the difference in taxes between the ag preserve tax and the tax at regular valuation.
Mr. Chair, the Senate has the identical provision, Article 2, Section 27.
Thank you, sir. Okay, item next.
And then next, Mr. Chairman, Hines. Would be Section 21 on the House side. Allows the Carleton County to make a levy for recreational purposes within the unorganized territory of Sawyer at up to $2,000 per year. This is they had this authority in the 90s, which I understand was to build a ice rink, I think, that their share, and then this allows them to levy for maintenance costs on that.
Mr. Chair, members, the Senate Article 2, Section 28, the levy portion itself, I believe, is identical. The only change would be found in the effective date. The Senate references a timely compliance as well as effective for taxes payable in 2015 thereafter. I believe those are sort of inconsequential differences in the effective date.
Thank you. And that looks like it for Article 3. We'll turn to Commissioner Bowerly. Actually, two are basically House provisions. So if you go back, maybe comment on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I think I'll reserve comment on Article 2, House Article 2 at this point, and I'll focus on the items that the staff discussed in Article 3 of the House and Article 2 of the Senate. With respect to the Board of Equalization courses for local boards, I just want to note that the department appreciates the partnership with the Association of Townships that we've been working on throughout this session, and we look forward to working together on this important training to ensure that we have consistent assessment and equalization across the state of Minnesota. With respect to a couple of provisions, the proposed levy certification, House Article 3, Section 10, Senate Article 2, Section 11, House Article 3, Sections 14, 15, and 16, Senate Article 2, Sections 19, 20, and 21. We think those are good provisions. We don't have any concerns at this time. And we do look forward to continuing discussion about SFIA and how we can help make that as administrable as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Item next would be Article 4, Estate Taxes. So if we bring research up for the estate tax, House, we'll have Mr. Joel Michael. Sylvia. Hey, Mr. Michael, if you want to start us through the estate taxes.
Mr. Chairman, the estate tax provisions are virtually all House provisions. There's one provision that says whatever changes you make in the definition of domicile, which were discussed relative to Article 1, would also apply to the estate tax, and that's the same in both bills. Otherwise, the Senate has no comparable estate tax provisions to the House, so there's really nothing to talk about.
Okay, Commissioner Bowerly, on Article 4, estate tax.
Mr. Chairman and members, with respect to the domicile issue that was just raised, we would just reiterate that we want to continue the conversation to make sure that the definitions are aligned.
Thank you. Members, Article 5, Economic Development. Mr. Michael, is that yours?
Yes.
Mr. Michael and Mr. Sylvia. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, the first comparable provision appears on page 35. It's section 16 of the House and Article 12, section 24 of the Senate. The House bill, this is relates to the border city aid, and what the House bill essentially provides a annual statutory $1 million appropriation for border city aid that would be a permanent appropriation rather than the sort of ad hoc biennium practice that's been used in the past.
Mr. Sylvia?
Mr. Chair, in Senate Article 3, excuse me, Senate Article 12, Section 24, the Senate provides for a one-time allocation of $2 million for the border city aid. In the past, I believe this has been made roughly every 2 years. This Senate provision is not ongoing, but a just one-time $2 million allocation.
Thank you. Mr. Michael?
The next provision is Section 17 of the House bill, and this essentially is just the reference to the findings for workforce housing when you use economic development provisions, and it's because it's essentially a cross-reference. It's the same in both bills. The Senate has different findings than the House, which we'll get to later on. I guess Section 19, which is the findings for tax increment financing workforce housing projects. The House authorizes the use of economic development TIF for workforce housing if the city makes a series of findings, which are detailed on page 36. It's limited to greater Minnesota cities. They have to have an average vacancy rate of 3%. A business that's located within the city or within 15 miles of the city that employs 20 or more FTEs has to have made a request to the city, and the city has to find that they intend to use it to assist workforce housing. And this is a permanent provision.
Mr. Sylvia?
Mr. Chair, the Senate authorizes the use of tax increment financing for workforce development. In the Senate, Article 6, Section 4, there are a number of additional factors that would be required to be met before the city or the authority could establish the district. So notable differences would be the city has a population greater than 1,000, having a median number of full-time jobs of at least 500 for the last 5 years. There are a number of counties that would be ineligible for a district to be established within. Fewer than four market rate residential rental units per 1,000 residents were constructed in the city in the last 10 years without any sort of government assistance or financing. And lastly, in the Senate provision, the authority to request certification of districts expires in June of 2020, so the authority to establish districts would be for just a five-year period.
The next provision, which is the same in both bills, is just the authority to actually spend the workforce housing economic development district increments, which is in Section 21 of the House bill and Section 5 of the Senate bill. Section 22 is also a workforce housing district, workforce housing TIF provision. This relates to housing districts. Housing districts, of course, are 25-year districts, whereas the economic development districts are 8-year districts. And essentially what the House provision says that if the project receives a grant from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency Challenge Program or from DEED, which does not have workforce housing programs, but in the House jobs bill, there is a proposal to give deed authority to make those grants. If a project gets a grant either from MFHA or from deed, then the income limits under the grant program would apply rather than the tax increment income limits for these 25-year housing districts.
Mr. Sylvia?
Mr. Chair, in Senate Article 6, Section 6, very similar language, except that the Senate does not include a reference to deed grant specifically and provides that the challenge income limits, the higher limits, are therefore substituted for the TIF income limits for housing districts. It also does not contain the House's deeming language.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, the next three provisions are all provisions from the League of Minnesota Cities bill that are the same in both the House and the Senate. They're relatively technical that essentially say that classic tax increments, the increments that are generated by the taxes paid, are the only increments that apply under the five-year and pooling rules. So it's not the income that's earned on those on properties bought with tax increment and that sort of thing. And like I said, they're the identical in both bills. Section 26 of the House bill is the interfund loan provision, and this contains a number of provisions where the House and Senate differ. And essentially what these provisions do is make documenting and approving interfund loans. These are instances where the cities have advanced money from other funds to a tax increment project and they intend to repay them with tax increments. How that's done, the House bill allows up to 60 days after the money has actually been transferred for them to approve the resolution. The development authority can delegate a staff person to give that person the ability to set the terms and conditions of the loan. Under the law now, that has to be done by the resolution approved by the governing body. Authorizes passage of the resolution after the TIF plan has been approved, and authorizes the development authority to rewrite those loan terms after the fact. It also contains provisions that say that basically you don't have to document an interfund loan if you're using it to pay admin or planning inspection that typically occurs before approval of the TIF plan, or to eliminate a negative balance that occurred in the previous year.
Mr. Sylvia?
Mr. Chair, Senate Article 3, Section 4, the difference is that the Senate does not include the language which allows the authority to designate a staff person to set the terms and conditions or to modify the terms and conditions and rewrite the loan terms. Under the Senate provision, that would still need a resolution action by the governing body. And on page 38, the Senate would not allow the use of interfund loans to pay those expenses listed, administrative expenses, planning, inspection, other types of expenses, and transfers in excess of a negative balance.
Mr. Michael?
The next provisions that are in both bills are the DMC provision. Section 27 of the House bill adds planning to the definition of what is a public infrastructure project that the city can then use its state aid and its sales taxes to pay. And that's the same in both bills. Section 28 is the provision that prohibits the Economic Development Agency down there, which is the nonprofit entity that was created by the Mayo Clinic, from requiring the city to pay amounts that are unrelated to the public infrastructure projects, and that, again, is the same in both bills.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sylvia, or Mr. Michael, the Senate Article 2, Section 26, has a blank next to it on the House side. Could you just explain that? Mr. Sylvia?
Mr. Chair, members, it should say there's nothing comparable. The House does not have any language dealing with the Lewis and Clark.
I think we should add that so it's just not system. An orphan.
Mr. Sylvia, which House section are you comparing to here?
Article 2, Section 26. It's a blank on the House side, and it should say no comparable provision.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Mr.
Sorry,
Michael.
Sorry we missed that. Section 29, again, is a BMC provision that modifies the special taxes that the city can apply. This is the lodging, liquor, and restaurant and admissions taxes. And this allows them to spend any money that they collect from that tax for anything that qualifies for the matching contribution. And Section 30 is an identical provision that applies to their local general sales tax provision, and both of those are identical in the House and Senate bill. Section 31 is really the operative provision that changes what they can count for the local matching contribution. Under current law, they're only allowed to count half of the amount that they spend for operations and admin of the corporation and the EDA, and what this does is allow them to count 100% of those amounts that they spend, and that's a permanent provision, which is where the Senate differs.
Mr. Chair, members, the difference is that the Senate ends the provision. It's not permanent. It ends on June 30th, 2020, when the one-half rule would resume.
Okay. Sure. Mr. Michael.
The next provision that's in both bills is the Coon Rapids special law provision for the Riverwalk project. What the House does, the House provision allows the uncapping of the original tax rate for this project. So their increment would be collected would be based on whatever the current tax rate is, not the certified original tax rate.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sylvia.
When the bill was introduced, it did have both of these sections. As Mr. Michael indicated, the unfreezing of the tax rate. The Senate does not include that. It includes the other provision, which simply extends the district by 5 years.
Section 36 is the Cottage Grove special law tax increment provision that extends the five-year rule through the end of 2016 for that Gateway North project. And that provision is the same in both bills. Section 37 is the Richfield special law TIF provision that allows a 10-year extension for the Cedar Avenue TIF district that's along the airport new north-south runway, and that's the same in both bills. Section 38 is the St. Paul special law tax increment provision, and that for the Ford Motor Company plant site. The House bill extends the period of time that the city can apply the special deeming blight test rule through the end of 2020. This allows the city to continue to treat those parcels as being occupied by a substandard building, even though the buildings have been removed by either the developer or the city.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sylvia.
The Senate, Article 3, Section 8, references the same location, the former Ford Motor Vehicle plant. The Senate also allows an exception to the blight test for establishing the redevelopment districts. It also exempts the district from pooling requirements, except that expenditures are subject to the percentage limits under current law. Additionally, it also exempts current law requirement that 90% of increment derived from the district must be spent to correct the conditions that justified establishing the district in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, that is all of the provisions in Article 5.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question similar to the one or point of clarification that I asked about that other provision. On page 41, there are blanks next to Senate provisions, Article 2, Section 33, and Article 2, Sections 34. But I do think that the House did have something. I was just trying to find it with regard to the Tennessee County provision, and I just wondered if the staff would clarify that, or is there no comparable provision?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, yes, the House does have a comparable provision on the emerged library that Ms. Pollack and Ms. Manzi went over before. It's on Section 38 of Article 1 of the House bill.
Was that Article 1 then?
Article 1, Section 38. It's on page 14 of the side-by-side.
Mr. Michael, what about?
What about the second
section
one?
No, Mr. Chairman, there is no comparable House provision for that. So it just should read no comparable provision.
Okay, let's go to the department. Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. With respect to this article, with respect to the border city provision, we do not have any concerns. With respect to TIF for workforce housing, it raises a larger issue with respect to workforce housing and the use of a tax increment financing tool. And so we would like to continue the conversation to make sure that this is workable for the benefit that the legislature seeks. We do appreciate the inclusion of provisions related to the Destination Medical Center. And with respect to the city-specific TIF provisions, we may have some small administrative issues that we would like to share with you and with staff just to make sure that they are as administrable as possible.
Thank you, Commissioner. Article 6, sales and use taxes. We'll go to from the House Research, we'll go to Ms. Pat Dalton.
Ms. Pollack.
Ms. Pollack? So we are on page 42. Who would like to start? Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first same or similar provision is House Article 6, House Section 6, Senate Section 3. Basically allows the same treatment on modular housing as we give to mobile manufactured housing and mobile homes. The sales tax would only apply to 65% of the price.
Pollack?
Mr. Chair, the Senate's provision is the same.
Dalton, next item.
Mr. Chair, the next item is on page 43. And it is Section 12 of the House and Section 4 of the Senate. This expands the current sales tax exemption for accessories and supplies used for durable medical equipment, which right now applies to purchases made under Medicare and Medicaid. And this expands it to cover purchases covered by an insurance plan. The House makes this expansion effective June 30th, 2015.
Mr. Chair, the Senate has the same provision but makes it retroactive to April 1 of 2009 and has some provisions to allow refunds for taxes paid if the purchaser did not, if that tax collect was not collected from the purchaser.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, the next similar provision would be Section 15 of the House and Section 5 of the Senate, and it relates to precious metal bullion. We are both providing an exemption. However, we have radically different definitions of what is meant by precious metal bullion. The House defines it as bullion that's 90% by weight of one of the listed precious metals. It has to be in the form of rounds, bars, or similar, and bought or sold on the spot market. The House also exempts bullion coins that meet the 90% of weight requirement, but does not need to be sold on the spot market.
Ms. Pollack?
Nothing further, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to talk about your, your definition is much different.
Okay.
Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair, the definition that the Senate uses for bullion is essentially provisions for investment that are required to be reported on internal revenue under Internal Revenue Code procedure. So this would also include jewelry or coins that would have value because of their rarity. I think that's the... Yes.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, the next similar provision would be on page 44, and it's House Section 18 and Senate Section 9, and that is expanding the nonprofits that are eligible for the sales tax exemption on their purchases, and I believe we have identical language.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. The provisions are identical.
Dalton?
The next, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the next same and similar provision is on page 45 of the side-by-side. It is House Section 20 and the Senate Section 10. It's expanding the number of days that a nonprofit can hold fundraising events on leased property on leased premises from 5 days to 10 days, and this is identical in both bills. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, the next similar section is Senate Section 7 and House Section 21 pertaining to animal shelters. The Senate provision exempts the sales of animals by the nonprofit shelter, and the House provision has several more components.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the House basically exempts virtually all purchases by animal shelters and virtually all sales by animal shelters.
I like that.
As well as all of their fundraising events.
Yes. Item next.
Mr. Chair, I believe the next provision is going to be on page 47. And it is sections 31 and 32 of the House bill and sections 18 and 19 of the Senate bill. This relates to expanding the area that Duluth may use spend their revenues from their food and beverage tax and hotel and motel tax, and we have identical language.
Nothing to add, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Dalton?
Do you want to start on the Mr. Chair, neither of us want to start on the next one, but we will give it a try. The next provisions, it's House Sections 33 through 36 and Section 38, and this corresponds to Senate Sections 20 through 23 and Section 25, and this relates to the Mankato and the North Mankato local sales tax provisions. These differ on allowed projects. Basically, the House only allows them to, the House does not allow the additional money for new recreational facilities that both of the cities had asked for. So there is differences in the amount of dollars raised. The House basically allows Mankato to raise $29 million, and the Senate allows them to raise an additional, besides the $29 million, an additional $25 million for the new recreational projects. There's differences in the expiration date. The House expiration date for Mankato is the earlier of 2032 or when revenues are sufficient to pay off the projects. The Senate has a different date. Theirs is 2038, and it's the later of 2038 or when revenues are sufficient to pay off the bonds. Because of the different levels of projects, we also have differences in the amount of bonding authorized. We both require a resolution by July 1 if the city of Mankato would like to extend the tax. But both still need to go to a referendum. The House requires the referendum be at a general election, and the Senate allows for either a special or general election. And I think those are
Ms.
the
Pollock?
Differences.
Do you want to talk about North Mankato?
You want? Okay. You can talk about
okay.
North Mankato.
Mr. Chair and members, I would just add that the Senate provisions on the Mankato local sales tax While the Senate does authorize the additional $25 million for some new projects under the Mankato Sales Tax Authority, it does require that the ballot questions for use of the existing sales tax to increase to the $29 million and the additional $25 million in bonding be on the same ballot question and be held on the same date in the same election as the North Mankato projects. And so now I'll talk about the North Mankato authorization. And this is House Section 38 and Senate Section 25. I'm sorry, and page 48 and 49 of the side-by-side. This authorization allows the city to extend its currently existing sales tax by an additional $9 million for currently authorized projects. There, in the Senate language, there's an additional $5 million allowed from that $9 million to be used for new regional athletic facilities that would be joint facilities used with the city of Mankato and paid for with the authorized Mankato local sales tax. Again, these two authorizations would have to be held in the same ballot on the same ballot question and be held at the same election as the Mankato reauthorization. So the effect would be if one of these does not pass, then both cannot move forward.
And Mr. Chair, the major difference is that Mankato must use all $9 million, North Mankato must use all $9 million for the existing projects in their current authorization. There's no allowance for using $5 million of it for new recreational facilities. And I believe our last same and similar is on page 50, and it is House Section 39 and Senate Section 29, and it is validation of the current City of Marshall sales tax, which the city just forgot to file with the Secretary of State.
So we're asking for permission instead of forgiveness instead of permission.
Mr. Chair, that would be correct.
Okay. Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. On Article 6, with respect to manufactured and modular housing, we would like to seek some clarity with respect to a couple of the definitions to make sure that we understand administrability. We are still reviewing the durable medical provisions. With respect to bullion, we would like to have some additional conversation to ensure that the definitions meet the appropriate coverage that is intended by the legislature. With respect to sales to nonprofits and the nonprofit eligibility, we would just like to flag for the committee that the department has a current rule on this topic, and so we would like to ask the committee to consider whether repealing that rule would be an appropriate addition to this provision in your bill. With respect to fundraising for animal shelters, I understand there's a great deal of history in this committee, and although Commissioner Franz took the white flag with him, we look forward to working with you on this provision as we move forward. And finally, with respect to specific city local taxes, we look forward to working with you on any administrability issues as you work through any differences in the language, but we don't have any other concerns with respect to those provisions.
Okay, thank you. We'll move on to our Chair Skoy.
Mr. Chair, the only thing I'd like to say is that with regard to Mankato and North Mankato, we've been trying to encourage the communities that have some of these local taxes to work on a regional basis, and so that's why we tied some of those provisions together. As we did with Brainerd and Baxter the last round, we're trying to get those communities to work together, so when we're contemplating that, we'll think about it. The Senate will be bringing that forward.
Yeah, they're Article 7. Mr. Clayman and Pollock.
Yes.
like to go first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Article 7, this would be on page 52 of the side-by-side. The only sections where there are similarities is in, well, I guess on page 52, section 1 deals with the definition of compressed natural gas, and the definition is changing from 1,000 BTUs to 900 BTUs. And these changes, I believe, were to conform to the way that the federal government makes that determination.
Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair, the Senate has the same language. It's contained in the Senate miscellaneous Article 12.
Okay, thank you. And that's it for Article 7? Or no?
One more.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Klayman?
Mr. Chair, the only other provision related to compressed natural gas would be on page 53, Article 7, Section 2. And that's a provision that just lowers the tax rate for compressed natural gas from $2.174 to $1.974 per 1,000 feet.
Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair, the Senate has the same language also in its miscellaneous Article 12.
Okay, thank you. To the Department, Commissioner Bauerle, on Article 7.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. With respect to the compressed natural gas provisions, we appreciate their inclusion. We think this is a benefit for taxpayers and for the department in administering this tax.
Thank you. Item next would be members, would be Article 8. We will have Dalton.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, there are no comparable provisions in Article 8.
Okay. Article 9. Ms. Dalton and
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Sylvia. Okay. Article 9. Who would like to start here? Mr. Sylvia?
I think the first name is Mr. Chair, I think that first one is actually on page 59. It's House Section 11 and Senate Section 6. Requires the state auditor to prescribe uniform reporting standards for all towns, and it's identical in both bills.
Mr. Chair. Okay, Senator Rest.
Looking back at page 57, Article 9, Section 3, that doesn't match up with Article 2, Section 12 in the Senate bill.
Section 3 matching with Article 2, Section 12.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sylvia.
The reason we didn't discuss those, they're two different type of tax credits. So even though we have separate tax credits, the reason we put them next to each other is because both are dealing with either the TNT notice or the actual property tax statement itself. But because they're completely different, we didn't think that we should bring them up at this time.
And Mr. Chairman, that's the same for Article 9, Section 6, and Article 2, Section 15. Same explanation.
Sylvia?
Mr. Chair and members, that is correct.
Okay. Ms. Dalton.
Just to also clarify further, on page 58, you will see that we have our Section 8 and the Senate Article 12, Section 21. Again, they deal with the same provision in law, but they're such different article provisions that we aren't going to discuss them at this time.
Okay. Item next.
I believe the next one would be on page 61.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sylvia.
The would be House Article 9, Section 17, Senate Article 5, Section 18. This would provide the City of Oslo forgiveness for their LGA for 2013. This is for failing to file the appropriate financial documents. This would provide the City of Oslo with the LGA forgiveness. They are the same in both bills. Senate Article 5, Section 19, this would provide three cities, Dundee, Jefferson, Woodstock, an LGA penalty forgiveness for failing to file their 2014, excuse me, failing to receive their 2014 LGA payments. The only difference is in the language itself. The House provision provides that any or all cities that did not receive their LGA payment, whereas the Senate just specifically lists the three eligible cities. And it's my understanding that those are the only three cities that would be covered by this provision.
Okay. Ms. Dalton, next, that's it for Article 9.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is it for Article 9.
To the department, Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. With respect to the provision with reporting, financial reporting and the state auditor, we will have some comments just about the effective dates and conforming those to when aid payments are made. And with respect to the LGA forgiveness, we don't have any issues, but just would like to note that that does need to be done in statute. We don't have the discretion to do that at the department. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Article 10.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Sylvia,
on page 66, Senate Article 12, Sections 3 and 4 concern the Minnesota Tax Court. This does three things. It increases from 15 to 30 days the time by which a motion for rehearing must be served. It also correspondingly increases the time in which a motion must be heard by the tax court. And lastly, increases the threshold for small claims divisions. This is not in the House tax bill, but I understand it's in a separate House bill, House file 849, which is apparently is currently in conference committee.
Mr. Michael or Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Which which policy area does House File 849 deal with? Is that the judiciary policy bill, or what is it?
No, Mr. Chair, I believe it's in the public whatever the public safety finance bill.
Public safety.
Judiciary.
Judiciary.
Public safety.
Public safety.
Public safety bill.
Senator Rest?
It's the public safety. And, Mr. Chairman, who are the chief conferees for that bill?
Cornish.
Bill Storm.
Latz.
I just need to know the chief. Cornish. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Article 10. Continue, please.
Mr. Chair. Payman. The next provision would be on page 66. Article 10, Section 15, Tax Incentive, New Producers of Direct Reduced Ore. The House version restores a tax incentive for new producers of direct reduced ore. In addition, the House version changes the definition of direct reduced ore, and from iron ore that's 75% iron to iron ore that's 67% iron plus no more than 3% alumina and silica. In addition, the House version it also exempts from the production tax the taconite used in the non-commercial production of direct reduced ore. And there's no sunset date to the tax incentive in the House version.
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair, the Senate bill contains a section that simply extends the sunset date right now in statute in order to be eligible for the phase-in of the production tax for these new facilities. Environmental permits would have to have been issued by July 1st, 2008. That date is changed to July 1st, 2020. That is the only changes being made. There are no definitional changes that would appear in the Senate article similar to the House.
Thank you. Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, we'll skip over, if you look on page 67, where there are entries on both sides. These are, this is an instance where provisions because they're in different places in the two bills, appear in the side-by-side twice. These are the same DMC provisions that we discussed earlier. So the next provision to cover is the on page 69, the estate tax, apportionment of estate tax burden. And I believe that the House, Senator Rest, attached this to a House file, and I believe the full House passed this today.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Michael, I was a little bit distracted there, but just repeat that and where you are.
Mr. Michael.
Ms. Chairman, Senator Rest, on page 69, the default apportionment of estate tax burden.
Oh, yes.
I believe that the House passed that provision that was attached to a House file, and that provision should be on it. It's identical in the both.
Yes.
In the Senate tax bill and the separate bill in the House, and I believe it's on its way to the governor.
That was
today,
Mr. Chairman. That was Senator Thompson's bill that dealt with other kinds of issues that lawyers care about. And so,
who was the House author on that?
Sir? I don't know who that is.
Smith.
This chairman is Representative Smith.
So it was Senator Thompson, and he agreed to let me put that purely policy amendment on his bill to dealt with a number of subjects, but not controversial.
Okay, Adam, next.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Klayman.
On page 69, Article 10, Section 21 of the House bill, automated sales suppression devices, also known as zappers. Section 21 just classifies sales suppression devices as contraband, which is then subject to forfeiture.
Okay. Mr. Sylvia?
Mr. Chair, Senate Article 12, Senate File Number 1603, Section 1, currently in general orders, it is the same provision.
Okay, very good. Adam, next, Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, continuing with zappers, Section 22, this is also on page 69. Use of automated sales suppression devices. This is the provision that sets forth the felony criminal penalty for the, maximum term of 5 years, $10,000, for the sale, purchase, installation, transfer, possession, accessing, and use of a sales suppression device.
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair, in that same Senate file number 1603, the same provision exists, except that the Senate includes a civil penalty that is not included in the House bill.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Section 23 of the House bill transfers an additional $150 million to the budget reserve account on July 1st of this year.
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair, in Senate File 888, Article 1, Section 39, requires the Commissioner of MMB to transfer $250 million to the budget reserve on July 1st, 2015.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that those are all of the provisions of that article that are comparable. And I think that other than the department articles, that's pretty much a catalog of all of the provisions that are in both bills and are roughly comparable.
Mr. Michael.
Ms. Manzi reminded me that the Senate repeals the purpose statements and we do them. So.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Senator Skoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's hard for me to not comment just briefly on this. We both have budget reserve provisions. The Senate also includes a date change reserve provision. So I'm going to try to bring that date change to the fore again, as we think that is a provision that's worthwhile having some conversation about.
Sir, Senator Skoy. So to the department, Commissioner Bowerly on Article 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. First, with respect to the provisions regarding the tax court, we don't have any concerns about the language themselves, but I will note for you that that will shift some of the costs for defending the state of Minnesota in those cases from the Attorney General's office to the department, and so we will have some costs with respect to that, and we'll be, we are compiling those, and we'll get those to you as soon as we can. With respect to the mineral provisions, we are still reviewing the specific with respect to reduced ore, but look forward to a larger conversation about mineral provisions as a whole. And finally, Mr. Chairman, we greatly appreciate the inclusion of sales suppression devices, also known as Zappers. We would like to continue the conversation about civil liability, and we are also developing some additional language for you to consider, and we appreciate the inclusion of this important enforcement provision.
Okay, let's go to this. Let's see, Article 7, Minerals. There's no comparable article. Who would like to, maybe from the Senate, go? Well, there's no same or similar then, so I guess we go by that. Okay, Article 9, Railroad, which we'll have discussions on later. Article. It. Okay, members, that's it for same and similars. Now let's go to fiscal with Ms. Schill, Ms. Templin, and
Ms. McQuaid.
Mrs.
McQuaid.
Ms. McQuaid. I'm sorry. Or Dr. McQuaid.
Okay, to the fiscal, who would like to start? Ms. McQuaid, Schill, or Templin? Ms. Schill.
Good afternoon, members. My name is Kathy Schill from House Fiscal. What we will start with is the summary sheet. You should have a spreadsheet of 18 pages that looks like this. And the summary sheet is the very first sheet. You have seven lines on this sheet. They are not numbered, but basically, this tells the big picture story. The second line is general fund revenue changes, and I'll turn to Ms. Templin for that portion.
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. For the House, in the fiscal 16-17 biennium, the fiscal summary shows that there are $2,419 billion in tax revenue reductions, and for the tails, there is a total of $3,371 billion in the fiscal 18-19 biennium.
Mr. Chair and Members, Shelby McQuay. With Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis, the Senate had a negligible reduction in general fund revenues in the 14-15 biennium. This was as a result of the federal conformity for the slain officers' contributions. The reductions in the 16-17 biennium total $166,012,000, and the 18-19 biennium totals $232,572,000.
Michelle?
Members, the next two lines show general fund expenditure changes. Only the House has a change in fiscal year 15. There's additional spending. This is an LGA early payment of $18,750,000. The next line down shows the changes offered by both the governor, House, and Senate for fiscals 16 through 19. The House has expenditure reductions totaling $147,789,000 in fiscal 16 and 17, and $203,658,000 in 18 and 19.
Mr. Chair and members, the Senate in the 16-17 biennium increases aids and credits by $291.6 million in the first biennium and $216.4 million in the second biennium. I'll just note that of the $291 in the first biennium, there's roughly $222 in one-time money there.
The next line gives you an idea of how the governor of the House, the Senate, compared to each other. And you'll notice that the figures for fiscal 16 and 17 have boxes around them. This will show you how the difference lies. The governor reduces revenues, that's revenues less expenditures, that's a net negative figure of $137,685,000 for fiscal 16 and 17. The House number is a negative $2,271,615,000, and then the Senate number.
Mr. Chair and members, the Senate in the first biennium totals $457.6 million reduction and a $448.9 million reduction in the second biennium.
And the House has the tails, a reduction of $3,167,970,000. The next two lines on the spreadsheet just talk about the transfers that were already discussed. You'll see this is basically a tracking of what those transfers are. They happen in fiscal 16 in each the House and the Senate, and that's basically what those lines are there for.
And, Mr. Chair and members, I'll just note that the Senate provision that transfers the $250 million into the general into the budget reserve was passed off the Senate floor in the state government bill, which was Senate Bill 888.
Templin?
Mr. Chair, one final comment about the budget reserve for the House. The increase of $150 million, that was not included in the House target and the House totals you see there for the fiscal 16-17 biennium. That was outside of the target. This was this increase in the budget reserve was to effectuate the budget resolution.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, would you like us to follow suit with counsel and research and just highlight the sames and similars, or would you like us to walk through the entire spreadsheet?
I think we'll do the same and similar.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of caveats before we begin going through the tax revenues. Keep in mind that the negatives in the tax revenues are revenue reductions and positives.
Excuse me, Senator Scoy. Chair Scoy.
Mr. McQuay, if you could help me just walk through briefly the differences between the parentheses on the total general fund changes and the expenditures. Are you starting back?
McQuay?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, Ms. Templin was walking through the negatives on the revenue side versus the expenditure side. And
we were thinking the same thing. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, I think what we'll do is I think we're probably good on the numbers unless members here have questions because we've gone through these. I think we've gone through them.
Sure.
Is that okay?
That's great.
Okay. So with that, would the department like to make any comments on the fiscal issues?
Probably. Not at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so and members, I've kind of memorized our spreadsheets here, and I know we've all gone through these in pretty great detail. So with that, same and similar, I guess, for the good of the order, Senator, like to dig into these issues further. Same and similar, Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would like to maybe request, like I mentioned at the beginning, that we ask the staff to come up with possibly for tomorrow the same and similars that we've gone over that are non-money items, and that maybe we could start adopting them. And also maybe take a look at the, I know you have them separately, but the departmental bills and maybe have some discussion about where it's appropriate to include them, rather keep them separate or bring them into the conference.
On the policy technical.
Yes, the policy. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so with that, tomorrow, I guess we can kind of wrap it up here. Oh, yeah, that's where I was going. That's where I was going next. As far as an agenda tomorrow, if you kind of give us maybe an outline of what we're looking at for tomorrow.
Sure. And, Mr. Chair, I think the schedule is the same for both bodies. We're going in around 11 and finishing up at 2 with the idea that we will start half hour after the last body adjourns. We do have a few areas that we'd like, and I'm going to have staff email this to you so you don't need to write it down, but I just thought for the public we might talk a little bit about what we would look at. And these are Senate provisions that I don't think the House has information or has had a look at that we think would be important to do. We'd like to start with some of the property tax provisions and perhaps the residence homestead target. We have a change that we've made there. We expanded the homestead target to include some agriculture provisions with regard to property tax. We, because of the work that was done with regard to ag land, are going to ask the department to do a production study. We'd like to talk about that. And then LGA, county program aid, township aid. Senator Lori had a bill in the Senate dealing with the Indian Child Welfare Act and the impact on counties, so we'd like to talk about that. As I mentioned earlier, we do have a redo of the Sustainable Forestry Initiative that I think we'd like to explain to the House. We have an article for workforce housing that we'd like to talk a little bit about tomorrow. And then last but not least, the energy study. The Senate Tax Committee put a lot of work into a redo of electrical generation, and we'd like the House to hear some of the work that we did there. And I think if we spend a couple hours on this list, we can work through it, and, you know, the list will be getting worked down pretty well for us. But it's some of the property tax stuff that the Senate has that I thought we'd work on tomorrow. And I think the CZAs are emailing the list out now, so everybody will have that on your emails. And half hour or so after last body adjourns would be my anticipated start time.
Okay, so we're looking about a half hour after the last body adjourns. And so that, anything else for the good of the order today? Comments to wrap up today's meeting? Commissioner Bauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Good to be here with you today. We don't have anything further today.
Oh, Mr. Chair, one more.
Chair Skoy.
Members, you can leave anything you want on the table. The sergeants lock this room up. This is the Tax Conference Committee's room for the duration now, and it's locked when we leave. And so you can feel free to leave stuff here if you choose.
Okay, with that, members, don't stop believing. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.